King Supreme, and he was a closet Lutheran too, he was a Franciscan friar. So, you know, this comes to court, and the church calls him into court. And, you know, then again, Standish sues in another court on primary, so this becomes this big case. So Henry calls the judges to Blackfriars, or the Dominican Priory in London, which also serves as a meeting place for Parliament. A lot of buildings in those days were dual use. And the judges render a verdict of, yes, indeed, this violates primary. The church can make no laws prejudicing the king's laws. So what's the logical consequence of this? The king really is, according to the laws of England, the head of the Church of England. All church revenues and income properly do belong to him. He's sitting there rather wide-eyed, bookmarked again for later. So Wolsey gets down and appeals to him to overturn the decision, and he won't. So now with this charge going through, the church can't claim exemption for these things. Now the murder charge goes in against the bishop's chancellor, but then they realize, well, they don't have any evidence, so they dismiss the case, and it goes away. But Henry has learned a lesson that he bookmarks for later. In the meantime, you have Pavia, you have the humiliation of Charles V, and now he's looking back to his own household. If Henry had died in 1525, he would have been yet another English king and tried to make England great again, but the European stage failed. Instead, he lives a little bit longer to effect something else that becomes a bit more long-lasting. So you see Catherine from 1509 to 1525 has changed a good bit by being perpetually pregnant. And so Henry, even though he still gives her a certain amount of honor and reverence, and certainly in conversation, he's no longer in love with her romantically. So he has a string of various mistresses. We've already mentioned Elizabeth Blount, who was early on. And his illegitimate son by her, Henry Fitzroy, is now set up in a parallel house, being taught and tutored at Henry's expense, just as Mary is likewise being set up. Now, Henry wasn't really convinced that a queen regnant would ever work in England. Catherine disagreed because her mother, after all, was queen in her own right of Castile. Surely, you know, in England it could work too. But English history has smiled on the female ruler, so it probably wasn't likely in Henry's mind that it could work. So he's looking elsewhere. What else can we do? The truth is, Henry has already decided that he needs to get an annulment from Catherine. He's already made the decision before Anne Boleyn even shows up on the scene. So it wasn't a question so much of Anne as who and when and how. And so one day, Anne Boleyn shows up in court and as a lady in waiting to Catherine. Now, she had been in, her father had been in ambassadorial service, and she'd been in the French court. She'd seen how the mistress thing works and how you get discarded rather promptly. And so she had preserved herself from that, but it paid very close attention. She was very bright, she was very witty, she was very fluent in French, and very widely French literature. And first she had attracted the attention of Lord Thomas Seymour, who hoped to, you know, when they started a romantic relationship. Then one day, Henry noticed, and it took Henry a while to notice her at court, but notice her, he did. She was sexy rather than beautiful, interesting, vivacious, and again, as mentioned, very fluent in French, which Henry liked to speak. And so this really appealed and attracted to him. So he got Wolsey to intervene with her potential betrothal to Lord Thomas Seymour. And he's ordered away from court. That makes her mad. She doesn't understand that that's coming from Henry. So you just see Wolsey as this meddling individual that's now wrecked her love life. And so she hates him very personally. And that will come back to bite Wolsey in just a little bit. So Wolsey, up to this point, Cardinal Wolsey, has been supreme in church and state. And of course, he's disliked by the aristocracy because he's the son of an Ipswich innkeeper, who's usually on the wrong side of the law, as we mentioned. But he's very brilliant, and he's managed to keep power by delivering to Henry everything he wants. And he keeps faction away in court. By controlling the access of Henry, he controls what goes on in court, and so he managed to keep faction away. This keeps him in power. But once you know it, Anne Boleyn wrecks it all, you know, because now Henry's infatuated with her. So Henry directs Wolsey in to arrange a secret trial where he has, it's all prearranged, it's all a show trial, a canonical trial, where he orders one of his gentlemen of the bedchamber to accuse Henry of having been in an invalid marriage to his brother's widow for all these years, and to thus to be living in sin. So Henry, you know, allows the charge to be given and then appeals to Wolsey for his judgment. And Wolsey, of course, knew about it. This was all being prepared. So he takes some days to make his judgment. Now, he could have done it right there and in secret because he's the Pope, he's the cardinal legatee. He's the Pope's representative in England. And Wolsey could have just decided to annul the case right there and annul the whole marriage. It would probably be forever before the Pope heard about it. What would he do after it was done? But something snapped in Wolsey, and he realized he could not do it. There was not only would it be invalid canonically, more than likely, because the dispensations from higher than him, he can't overrule it. But even worse, he feared, you know, the wrecking of his chances of ever climbing the ecclesiastical ladder, or maybe he just had a pang of conscience. I can't do this. So he remitted the case to Rome. In the meantime, Henry had made his affections known to Anne Boleyn. Most people know this story, but in any event, he had sent her a letter asking her to become his mistress. And she, having seen how the game worked, not to mention her older sister had already been in relations with Henry and been married off to some other noble, right? So she used and discarded. So she saw that and just wanted to go the same way. She said no. And this made Henry, you know, moved, right? This is romantic. Who can tell a king no? Well, he can't do anything about it because the propriety is at stake. And so this just enlivens him. And he starts to get very romantic and pursues his affections. So this is the origin of devising this plan. How am I going to get out of my marriage? Oh, I know. Annulment. Improperly called divorce, because nobody got divorced in England until about the 1670s, but a formal divorce. So Wolsey remits the case to Rome, where he hopes to use his agents to secure favor from the Pope. That way it can't be reversed to create more problems for him. So, problem is he picked the exact worst time. So Clement VII, who was another ministry pope, actually. He had Leo X, and then he had Pope Adrian's, Pope Adrian VI. Yeah, Albert Uhtred, Pope Adrian VI. Then you get Clement VII. Now Clement kind of started out as a reformer. He was interested in reforming the church, and he just kind of falls away from his purpose. Goes back into old Medici games. And so Charles V was becoming a little more demanding, and he saw the French seemed to have more power, so he made a decision. I'm going to side with the French this time. Bad move. So Francois I, in the meantime, left him in a Spanish prison. He managed to work out a deal with Charles, but he'll be restored to France if he sends his sons to imperial keeping for you know, his good behavior. And then later, another deal is brokered, so they're out. So again, because the problem is, you know, normally a king doesn't kill another king. So what do you do with them? That's why eventually it's usually more wise to send him back. And so anyway, the war goes on again. Charles beats Francois, and now he's looking down into Rome. Clement, you picked the wrong time to switch sides. So he sent his army within sight of Rome in order to give us a subtle threat. The problem was he also neglected to pay his army. So they mutinied, and they went into a riot. They stormed Rome and sacked it. And it almost burned the entire city to the ground. So Rome was drunk on the wine of the Renaissance. And priests lived openly in concubinage. Religion was not being provided for right in the heart of Rome. St. John Fisher actually makes a very pointed note of this in his reply to a certain Protestant, where he says that, you know, he quotes the Protestant as saying that, you know, in Rome, the morals are worse than anywhere else in Christendom, and nobody fasts, and priests would neglect their vows. So how could the Pope have, you know, this authority? And he responds, rather than cut down our argument, this proves the very thing we're saying. Because how is it this is the only apostolic see which has not been conquered by infidels, even though it has deserved it 1,000 times over? So Fisher did not mince his words in his criticism of the Rome of his day. And it really was bad. So the German soldiery sacks the city, and amongst them were 10,000 Lutheran troops who do quite a bit of damage. If you've ever gone to the Vatican Museums, you can see the Santa de Raffaele, the Raphael rooms. Raphael painted, for example, famous school of Athens. Facing that is the Disputation on the Eucharist. And right underneath that, one of the soldiers had carved in Luther's name with a sword into the wall. So it wasn't much of a, of course, this gives a permanent distaste in Rome for Germans, right? Which lasts for 100 or so years, but it still hasn't gone away altogether. So it just dwindles down a little bit. So the city's a mess. The Pope, Clement VII, he flees to the Castel Sant'Angelo, the ridge of the Mausoleum of Hadrian that had been built up into this medieval fortress, so called because, if you know that story, St. Gregory the Great was processing through Rome, and he looked up in Hadrian's mausoleum and said they were processing to stop the plague. And he saw an angel land there and sheathed his sword. And then it was a sign the plague was over, and it was. So then they put a statue of an angel up there to commemorate the vision, called the Castel Sant'Angelo, the Castle of the Holy Angel. So now, being in Castel Sant'Angelo, even though it was well fortified, Charles had him exactly where he wanted. He couldn't leave without his say-so. So when the appeal of Wolsey about the old dispensation of Julius, asking him to set that aside and annul Henry's marriage to Catherine, when he gets to Rome, the Pope is in Charles V's power, and the Emperor Charles V, now fully in control of the situation, and the Pope is not going to let this happen. So Wolsey now is in a lot of trouble, because he was depending on all his, you know, his friends and in Rome to help him out, and now they're either dead or fled, and the Pope is in the Charles's power. So Wolsey goes and he consults St. John Fisher. He consults a number of people, so they start working up a new canonical case. Let's start looking for scriptural reasons for, you know, anything in the theology that would help us. And so Henry puts his finger on Leviticus. It's a verse in Leviticus that says, if a man marries his brother's widow, it is an unclean thing, and they shall be childless. So Henry takes this verse to mean, oh, well, the Pope couldn't dispense against it because it was divine law. See, the scriptural teaching is clear. So Wolsey goes to Fisher, and so mentioning it in the third person, someone, let's just say there was somebody who might have been, Fisher's not stupid, he knows exactly what's going on. Because he'd been in Catherine's chapel for a long time, he knew exactly what was being whispered behind the scenes. So Wolsey lays out the case, and he says, well, what now? Fisher looks at it and says, well, it's quite simple. The church fathers have the answer. We combine this up with the verse of Deuteronomy, which says that if a brother dies childless, or if a brother dies childless, marry his widow and raise up children to his name. So they say that we combine those two verses in the case of this, even if, you know, normally, you know, you wouldn't look at that. The fathers say, yeah, that's what you do. And that was the medieval answer, really, to that question. Rather than looking at it today, where is that verse of Leviticus is part of the law that's dispensed with the gospel, right? That's how we look at it. Theologians look at it since then. But at the time, they said, no, we'll put the verses together. So what Henry knew was perfectly right, and the Pope was perfectly in his authority. Unless there's a problem with the bull. So Wolsey shows the bull, and they look at it, and it said, you know, it doesn't really make it clear, right? So, and this was what Wolsey was afraid of. He was afraid because Watt, the most famous theologian in all Christendom, one guy that took up his pen against Luther, that Luther never answered because he didn't dare, because he's the holiest bishop in Christendom. You don't dare say anything bad about it because there's nothing bad to say about it, because everybody knows that what a good bishop he is. So Wolsey's kind of distraught, so he goes back to Henry, and Henry calls him, because Henry's really eager to get Fisher on his case, because he's convinced that Fisher's on his side. Well, that means that the Pope will be on his side. So Henry, you know, lays out his case and his concerns, and then Fisher immediately stops and says, my lord, I will lay out before you to clear up this scruple. And he lays out all the reasons for why his marriage to Catherine was perfectly good, all theological. He thinks Henry just couldn't answer it. So then Henry, you know, thanked him, wished him a good day, and according to an early biographer of John Fisher, as he left, he knew the king never looked upon him with favor ever again. Because Henry was a man who wanted to get, you know, whatever he wanted. Couldn't, very upset. So in good days, he's a great guy, and in bad days, get out quick. Although some people can't. Catherine certainly wouldn't. So the legatine court is formed. So Henry appeals to the Pope and says, please, hurry up this process. You know, you see my cardinals, you know, replying. The Pope gets free. He's now in Ancona under his own auspices, away from Charles V. So he grants, first he grants what Wolsey was asking, giving Wolsey the power to hear the case in England and make the decision irreversible. But he yielded in a weak moment, so then he made another bull quickly with Cardinal Campeggio, who had been in England several times before, is one of his men, to noted candidates to go to England and help Wolsey adjudicate that case. He also sent Campeggio with a secret instruction. There's Campeggio right there. He sent him with a secret instruction to delay, and in the end, just revoke the case back to Rome anyway. Don't do anything certain. It's like the exact opposite of what Henry wants. And in the meantime, he and Anne are getting more restless, but with the hope that this will solve the problem. So they convene the legatine court. Catherine is not allowed to see the people that are going to be in her defense, Bishop Warham, Bishop of Canterbury, and St. John Fisher. And Henry decided he's going to have Wolsey and Campeggio. So Campeggio decides, you know, maybe this, we need to head this off. He goes to Catherine and suggests to her, why don't you enter a convent, become a nun? And that will solve the whole matter. And she says, no, I don't have a vocation. I have my vocation, my call to be the Queen of England. I'm the daughter of Isabella. I'm a queen, not a nun. So that kind of fails. Didn't really work. So Campeggio then hears the case. And so Shakespeare, in his play, Henry VIII, Act 4, substantially relates what was actually said there. And it's found in William Rascal's account of the Legatine Court. But she declares unto him, haven't all these years I been a faithful wife? All these years, have I not served you? Have I not loved you? Have I not been faithful to you? And it puts Henry on the spot. And remember, he's not good at confrontation. This is Wolsey that he was working for. Now he's on the spot. And he's in Blackfriars. He's in the public eye. And so he asks to confess. Well, yes, of course. And then how could our marriage not be good? He has no answer. He's stumbling over his words. Because he still has a certain reverence for his wife, even though he's been completely mistreating her all these years. And he just can't get his case out. He looks ridiculous. So then she bids him farewell and departs and doesn't come back. So the court declares her contumacious in the proceedings, and they ask if anyone had any further objections. Now, previous to this, all the bishops and Catholics are instructed to be quiet. Fisher just was quiet. Because silence can veil assent and also veil dissent. And Fisher dissented. So he got up and started to relate various treatises that he had written on the matter of Henry and Anne's marriage, and gave a very long speech which impressed everyone there, and even Campeggio had to stop, because he realized that Fisher really knew what he was talking about, and declared the case for why Catherine's and Henry's marriage was beyond a doubt valid. Now, Thomas More also supported Catherine. And here I got to stop, because if you read Characters of the Reformation by Hilaire Belloc, Belloc was a very good historian, but he got this completely wrong. In his character treatment of Thomas More, he says that More supported the divorce and only had the problem with the supremacy, and that's completely false. We'll go over that again when we get to that element. So rather, More supported her in secret, but he also works for Henry in an official capacity, so he keeps his opinions to himself and is very discreet. That's one of the reasons More sticks around so long. He's always been a discreet counselor. He's always been the most honest in all of his dealings. He's always the most just, and there's nothing that Henry can say against him. So. But Fisher is the one who puts his neck out for marriage, right? Literally. And it gets Henry's absolute wrath as he stands up and more or less saves the situation for Catherine. The argument seemed unanswerable, and he declared, I am prepared, like a modern-day John the Baptist, to lay down my life for this true marriage. And of course, a few years later, Henry would oblige. But he couldn't take this, so he instructs one of his lackeys, Stephen Gardiner, lately made the bishop of Winchester, to take up the case for Henry. And then he goes on trying to present Henry's case again, and he gets angry that Fisher dared to declare Henry to Herod and declare again what a just prince Henry was. But did either Henry or Gardiner remember, 7 years later, that after they had killed Fisher, that Herod had actually killed John the Baptist? And it's interesting, Fisher also has a very strong devotion to John the Baptist. He's named after him. So he's seeing right now the writing on the wall of where it's all going. Almost prophetically. Well, Campeggio hears all the testimony, he gets everything together, and as they're sitting there, he finally decides that the case is too difficult, it needs to be adjourned for a while, but we think about it. But it never met again. Once he was safely off English soil, he revoked the case back to Rome for the Pope's judgment, Pope Clement VII's judgment. Wolsey had failed in this last endeavor, the one that became the most important to Henry. He got Henry virtually everything else he ever wanted, but in this one case he wouldn't. So Henry stripped him of the Lord High Chancellorship, and Wolsey went back to York, where he was technically the Cardinal Archbishop, although he had only actually resided there twice, and so started belatedly taking up management of his diocese. The next year, 1529, a heresy trial starts, or not heresy trial, sorry, a treason trial starts, similar to them, and Wolsey is called in and to be killed for treason. He's not even rising to use the bathroom. He's staying at his desk and just writing and writing. And in the end, it's to no avail. He's summoned to Henry's treason trial, and on the way, he dies out of fear. And he declares, would that I have served my God as well as I have served my king. But in the end, neither was good enough. So Wolsey ends up dying, and in his absence, St. Thomas More is picked by Henry to be chancellor, the Lord High Chancellor, the very highest judicial post in the land. And thus you see More here in his judicial robes with the collar, which is his chain of office as chancellor. Now More, on the other hand, is very just, as he goes says about his work, and he cleans out the whole caseload that's before the king's courts, because Wolsey almost never took his duty seriously. So More takes these cases, stretching back to 10 or 15 years, and gets them all resolved. He tries to get people the out-of-court settlements. People try to bribe him. There's one famous story where he was given a cup. It's a very beautiful cup, gilt with jewels and everything. So he poured wine, drank it to the health of the person who sent it, and then sent it back. Right? He's ready to be bribed. Another time he got a cup, and it was also very beautiful, and he exchanged it for one he had of lesser worth. And, I'm sorry, the other way around. It was lesser worth. He sent, took one he had that was of more worth, and sent that one back instead. Right, to the other day. More, on the other hand, in Henry's court, now has to deal with the fact that Henry is leaning heavily on him to promote the divorce. So he has all of his lawyers, his bishops that are his side, present the case of the invalid marriage. More is just not convinced, so he promises Henry that he will do nothing for it and nothing against it, so long as he's High Chancellor. And Henry, who'd always known him to be a just man, a fair man, had to accept it, so he did. But he's not particularly happy, so now he's sitting in the situation where the legatine courts fail, the Pope is just taking forever, and he really, truly wants to lie with his beloved. Anne is also getting a bit restless, too. Her condition is she wants to be the queen, and she sees it almost in her sight, only this church obstacle giving us. So she goes to teasing Henry. So this is her Book of Hours, and there is an inscription here, which is very hard to make out, but here, we daily prove you shall be fine to be both loving and kind. And look at what she's done, which this is on the bottom of the page right here. Right? And so she's left it in the Chapel Royal for Henry to find. And Henry finds it. And look what's being suggested. Okay? Annunciation, fertility. Your wife can't provide you this, but I can. Just a little longer. I'm ready. Henry sees it and responds in kind. Interestingly, note which picture, the suffering servant, long suffering, just as he's suffering, not being able to embrace his beloved. He's left here a little note for Anne. These are all in the British Library. And of course, I don't know the French. I can read it, but absolutely butcher the French if I even try. If you remember my love in your prayers as strongly as I adore you, I shall hardly be forgotten, for I am yours, Henry Rex, forever. So it's a little, this wasn't limited to Anne's Book of Hours, because it also continued into love letters, which somehow were smuggled out by a spy into the Vatican. So as Henry is citing his conscience will not allow him to lay with his true wife, he's sitting on these love letters between Henry and Anne, and the Pope's at this conscience, eh? Well, yes. So Henry then, it's not a good thing for him, and he asked the Pope to give another dispensation, dispense him from his adulterous relations with Anne Boleyn's sister, so that he can marry Anne. So he still believes in dispensations, but nevertheless, he's got to take a different tack. So the first thing is Parliament. So he opens up a Parliament in 1529, More presiding as the Lord High Chancellor, and it's called the Reformation Parliament, because it would continuously sit in by legislation that served Henry's purposes. So the first attack is on the independence of the church. There were Lutherans present in this parliament. So the first element, in 1530, the Commons advanced legislation to correct abuses in the church, which actually is stripping clerical privilege and the end church independence. There's other things as well, trying to regulate how the church would make laws, trying to regulate even the income and revenues of bishops. So St. John Fisher tries to bring up the resistance to the House of Lords, right? And so the aristocracy sees what he's talking about, and they come to his assistance because it's going to threaten the independence of the church. So the Commons, headed by Sir Thomas Audley becomes an important figure later. He's one of these creatures that just do whatever Henry wants, so he manages to survive all the way to 1547 when Henry dies. One of the few. Well, he goes to make a complaint. Fisher is attacking us. The bishop called us heretics. And so, you know, but Henry couldn't really argue with Fisher's logic, so he just says, just speak more tactfully. But now he's marked. And all the clergy. So we mentioned Primonere. And so Henry, bookmarked for later, now is later. Well, the clergy were in a convocation. Convocation is like a plenary council, similar to like when the USCCB meets, for example. All of the bishops in England met to manage certain things in 1531. So Henry sends them a messenger that they're in violation of primonere because they accepted Wolsey's cardinal legatine authority, that he accepted as the papal authority behind Wolsey. And that was primonere. Of course, let's not mention anyone who did resist it would be in the Tower, and that Henry had foisted it on them, but that didn't matter. We're not in the mood for facts right now. So as a result, Henry demanded £100,000 for them to swear that he has the title of the head of the Church of England. Now, Bishop Warham is the ordinary. He's the metropolitan. So Canterbury had been the metropolitan see for as long, even before England was England. But his rights have been trampled on by Wolsey. And he doesn't have the courage to resist the king. So Fisher tries to get the resistance. Nobody's interested. Nobody wants to get involved. Everyone's like, well, can't we just get the king what he wants? But they realize the problem. So he says, well, how about this? Let us say, praetor nation Christi permittat. As far as the law of Christ will permit it, we'll accept him as head of the church. And if we can do that, then let's do it. And so everyone goes on to the qualifier. Warham signs on to it. And so Henry's a little less than pleased, but at the same time, he realizes it can be read either way. Now, Moore, we had mentioned, had done a fantastic job as chancellor, and you know, but now he's just hard put to it. He sees Henry is openly has Anne Boleyn running around wearing the Queen's jewels. Catherine is restricted to one specific house and not allowed to see either her daughter Mary or Henry. And now the official state policy is to support the Dorsets. He's feeling more and more uncomfortable with the attack on the church. He sees where it's all going. So at the very last, with a heavy heart, he resigns to Henry and gives him the Lord High Chancellor. One of the things he hadn't counted on is that he couldn't just be left alone because he had spent his time as Lord High Chancellor prosecuting heretics, raiding places where Lutheran books were entering the country, and handing over the criminals over to the church to be tried for heresy. So Moore would have a number of enemies that are now jumping to Henry's side that are ready to, you know, to savage him. We'll see this very soon. The petition. So this is the petition that was sent to the Pope by English nobility and gentlemen. The only people that in Henry's Privy Council or his immediate circle that absented themselves were the St. Thomas More, St. John Fisher, and Bishop Warham also, but he was too old, he was getting sick at this point. So they didn't pester him too much. But see all their seals down below. This is in the Vatican Museum currently. And to be consulted there. So it's an appeal to the Pope to decide for the sake of the kingdom in Henry's favor. It was delivered by one Stephen Gardiner, the same one that tried to take Henry's side against Fisher in the legatine court. Gardiner is interesting because he will pull Henry's side as long as he can, and then he will end up, during Mary's reign, on the Catholic side once again, switch sides. They could possibly do the prayers of John Fisher, as we'll see. So the petition then is sent to the Pope, and in the meantime, Henry is soliciting European opinion. Let's go to the universities. Let's go, you know, to everywhere. So he's got agents running around here trying to get doctors of canon law, of theology, to come on his side. And so now the matter of his marriage and obviously his paramour are, you know, publicly, you know, flouted in front of all Christendom. But and very unpopular in London itself. Very unpopular. Eustace Chapuis, who's Charles V's ambassador in London, writes about the daily jeers and taunts, where the people love Queen Catherine. And they called Anne a witch, a whore, and a heretic. And so even the Protestants had no love for her. So this was something that was a big problem for Henry. So he's got to overcome things. He sends Thomas Abel, who was Queen Catherine's chaplain, to Spain. And Abel had offered to find evidence, find things favorable to Henry in Spain. So he sends him down to get the favor of the Spanish universities. But he's a double agent. In fact, he gets all the information useful to Catherine, publishes it in this book, Invicta Veritas, Unconquered Truth, proving the case that Henry's marriage to Catherine was valid. And this is Henry VIII's copy. Now, the consequent, of course, the left, as Thomas Abel puts his monograph and the bell in the tower where he was imprisoned until much later when he was killed. Obviously, the result. Henry reads the book, and inside there's a marginal notation in English, which, because he got so mad, he lowered his skull, because he normally annotated in Latin. So he lowered his scholarly bent for just a minute. Then he recomposed himself and writes in Latin on the front, the entire case, the basis of this case is false. Right? It's already, you know, rejected papal authority. He's just lining up everything he can, just in case the Pope doesn't give him what he wants. Warham, who'd been the Archbishop of Canterbury for the last 35 years, dies. At the very end, he was put up on a charge of praemunire because he had consecrated some bishops without getting the king's approval. And Warham wrote back, this is the very thing for which Thomas of Canterbury, that is St. Thomas Becket, died. How then can I be praemunire for this? But he, you know, he died shortly thereafter of old age, and Henry's like, well, I made that easy. Now, who to put in? And he had just the man. The chaplain for the Boleyns, Thomas Cranmer, an otherwise obscure Cambridge don, had come to Henry, and this is why the thrust of the attack of the church begins. And he had whispered to Henry, psst, you read the Bible, right? Of course I read the Bible. What do you have for me? Well, there's kings in the Bible, right? Of course. There's bishops in the Bible, right? Of course. See any popes? I don't see any popes. Maybe the papacy is just a human invention. Just a bishop in Rome. And he's not the Pope. Henry thinks about it, and he sees the consequence. I can reject the Pope and annul my own case. It's solved. I just need a good, pliant archbishop. What do you know? We have a vacancy. So Cranmer, and Cranmer is the perfect court archbishop. He will do whatever he's asked to do, as long as he stays on Henry's side, because that's where his power comes from. So he even burns men who believe the very same things that he believes. Cranmer's a big Lutheran, but he has to do it in order to appease Henry. Okay? So he has no qualms about that. He has a secret wife that Henry can't know about because if he does, he'd have him killed because Henry's trying to defend Clara himself, so even long into the Protestant years. So Cranmer is the perfect guy to do whatever the king wants. And he doesn't get free to do what he wants until after Henry's long dead. So Cranmer then is the new Archbishop of Canterbury. Now Rome, again, like you said, would prove anybody the king sent as a bishop as long as they got Leonati's text. And Henry, of course, had recent communications with the Pope, and he thought they were on good terms. So the Pope said, all right, I'll approve his choice, knowing virtually nothing about Cranmer. So Cranmer becomes the Archbishop of Canterbury. The very first thing they do is put through some laws in Parliament, stopping Leonates, declaring the king has full authority to make him to circumscribe canon law. And then he goes in and annuls his marriage to Catherine on the grounds of consanguinity, rejecting formally the authority of the Pope, and thus declaring Henry and Anne to be husband and wife, king and queen. And thus begins the real break with Rome. So the very act itself is a denial of papal authority. The Pope waits for a very long time, and then finally excommunicates Henry for it all and decides his marriage to Catherine was valid. Belatedly, he could have done that a few years earlier. And so More is at his estates. Fisher decides to keep quiet now. He's lost, and his ordinary, the Cranmer now, is his ordinary, he's already absolved Catherine's union. So he decides just he's going to continue, but be quiet and not publish any more books on the matter, and just kind of keep his head out of it. More likewise. So he hears about it first, and he says, oh, perhaps this thing will be confirmed with oaths. But then it goes deeper. He even gets incriminated in a certain treason case, which turned out to be all trumped up. So then he simply responds to his daughter, Meg, quod deferter non auferter. What is delayed is not removed. Simply, it's a quote. Most historians didn't understand what he meant by this, and it's been debated what he was talking about. It's from the Chronicle of Southern Dave, and it's from a monk who refused, who denied Frederick II had the authority he had, and he knew he was going to be killed for it, so he uttered these lines, meaning that he's telling his daughter, Meg, who's the only one to get it, I'm going to die. And he knows it at this point, once he gets it. Wolsey's fall had brought out a certain man, and this is really one of the geniuses behind all of Henry's architecture, Thomas Cromwell. Now, Cromwell was a servant Wolsey. He was a secretary for Wolsey. He survives Wolsey's fall and climbs to the top, becomes Henry's secretary of letters. He's also a Lutheran, private Lutheran. He'd met with other people, including Cranmer, back in olden days. And he's a brilliant political machinator. He knows exactly how to move and shape things. So he's been the one with Cranmer working on the legislation. So now they try to get... I'm going to skip this. This is the treason plot. The nun of Kent, she had a revelation. Just maybe Henry might be violating God's will by marrying Anne. And so that she was alleged to have various visions. So Cromwell tried to implicate Fisher and Moore and others into this as a big treason plot. It ultimately fails because they both have too much evidence. They have nothing to do with it. So I don't have more time to go into that. So we've got to get to the juicy stuff. More legislation. The Heresy Act. Parliament restrains bishops from initiating cases of heresy. Speak against the Bishop of Rome is no longer considered heresy. Submission of clergy to the king. Clergy are forbidden to assemble in convocation, that is a local council, without the king's writ. Appeals to Rome are forbidden. The Anantes tax. Everyone hated this tax. It served a purpose in the 11th century, but now it didn't. Just to enrich the Pope a little bit. Well, Henry doesn't get rid of it either. No, so much for the Reformation. Instead, the Anantes goes to him. And it stayed that way all the way until the late 19th century, by the way. That never got rid of it in England. Everywhere else they got rid of it in Europe, but not in England. They kept it just to the king. All dispensations were within the power of the Archbishop of Canterbury. Cranmer, which is really saying Henry, because Cranmer is going to do what Henry wants. So now the problem was Fisher and Moore, who were still there, everyone knew what they thought, even though they weren't talking. And Anne Boleyn was extremely vindictive. Thomas More was asked to be a part of the coronation mass for Anne, and he didn't show up. And so she took it as a snub. So she decided that they needed to be dealt with. So encouraged Henry, through Cromwell, to enact some new legislation. Fisher also had been Sunday and showed that you know, he needed to be dealt with by hook or by crook. Or in one case, by cook, as Anne Boleyn's household had paid a cook to introduce poison into the food of Fisher's household, which did kill the servant and made others very sick, but not Fisher, because he was fasting that day, so he actually didn't eat. Lucky him. So then Henry, you know, feigned, you know, horror at it, and then the cook killed, you know, executed, but because he actually had a fear of poison, so he might not have actually known about it until after the fact. But next, Thomas Boleyn, Anne's father, had shot a cannon into Fisher's Lambeth residence and shattering windows. So Fisher took the hit and made his way back up to Rochester. So now they could not be allowed to sit idly by. The Act of Succession, 1 May 1534, requires all subjects to swear preamble that the marriage of Henry and Catherine was invalid and the marriage to Anne is valid. Furthermore, all subjects must acknowledge Henry and Anne's issue, that is their children, as the true and proper heirs of the crown imperial. Bastardizes Princess Mary formally. And so she's no longer supposed to be a princess, but I don't have time to talk about Mary, unfortunately. Any subject that refuses the oath forfeits their property and is imprisoned for life. And so what happens is Fisher and Moore are both ordered, but Moore is ordered to be there first, front and center, ahead of all other clergy, to take the oath. So he asks for an hour to study it, and he looks it over. And then in the meantime, they start administering the oath to others. Fisher and Moore see each other, like I mentioned, they had some communications in the past. They made their acquaintances and knew each other both to be very good and devout men. But Fisher was much older than Moore, and they ran in different circles. It's only now that they'll be joined in the next year and a half or so. Fisher then is given the oath, and he looks it over, and he's willing to swear to the issue that is, yeah, Parliament can make laws about who's going to succeed and who's not, but he can't admit to preamble, because it's tantamount to denying the Pope's authority. So he's put in the tower. Think it over. Moore likewise has the same objections. He's put in the tower. A Tower of London was built by William the Conqueror as a citadel and fortification in times of war for the royal family to escape to, and then was turned later into a prison to put people into. It had different wings. Some wings were very mannerly and prepared for wealthy guests, and some places were not. Rather for wretched prisoners like the ones it's now getting. The only saving grace for both Moore and Fisher is the warden of the tower hated Cromwell, so he was willing to do a lot, give them a lot of favors. When you were in the tower, you had to pay for your stay there, even though you didn't have any choice about it. So Fisher and Moore, you know, they had their estates had to be liquidated to pay for this. Now Moore was pretty wise. He had set up a trust with all his property and all his possessions left, so it was no longer his. And he made it his daughter and his son-in-law, Wayne Roper, as the executives of the trust. So when Henry went to confiscate his property, there wasn't any. That really made Henry upset. But one of the things that Moore has that to his great assistance, because he felt many times he would fail under the fear of what was coming, but his daughter came to be with him. This is the way it happened, because Cromwell had ordered nobody should be in, nobody sees them. Then Meg went. Now her husband, Wayne Roper, he comes out in history as looking rather good for some reason. He's actually really shameless and very self-serving. So, but he did in the end write a biography of Moore with all of his wife's paperwork, so it, you know, he left us that. But anyway, he took the oath. He had no problem with the oath. Margaret did. She shared her father's views, but she had that problem. So she went and swore the oath with a saving clause, you know, as far as the law of Christ allowed. So that way, in her own mind, she could deny it, but it would look like she's affirming it. Cromwell accepted it for two reasons. One, she didn't need to swear at all. And two, this made him think that maybe, just maybe, she would prevail upon Moore to accept the act of succession, and later the royal supremacy. So she comes in, and she's his great assistant for all this time, and she helps him to write the Dialogue of Comfort. They write up various plays, like a trial, where someone's going to be tried for not swearing an oath, right, namely what's going on presently. And she gives him the strength to trust, because he to get over his fears of what he knows is coming, because he knows he's dead. It's only a matter of time before Henry can do something. He and Fisher both adopt the position that they will not, under any circumstances, swear, even if they're told the other one is swearing. They will not gainsay the succession either, they will just be silent. Essentially, that they're guilty of thought crime. Fisher was put in the tower, and he had a higher rank. He was not allowed to have any books at all. He had to stay in the tower, he wasn't allowed to say mass, and he was stripped of his episcopate, and every bit of his possessions were confiscated. Now, when Cromwell's men get to Rochester, they go through his residence, and they find everything. It's all listed in the inventory as being old. In his own bedchamber, a bedstead and mattress, a counterpane of red cloth lined with canvas, a tester of old red velvet, nothing worth, a leather chair with a cushion, an altar with a hanging of white and green satin rouge, their lord embroidered on it, two old blue silk curtains covered with a coil, a little chair, a close stool with old cushion on it, and the north study, diverse glass of waters and syrups, because he actually was in the early stages of liver failure, so he had to take a very specific diet. In the chapel, a cushion in the seat of the chapel, the altar cloths, two pieces of old velvet, and the altar stone, four gilt images of the crucifix. Okay. Not sure why that didn't come up. So the next thing that they note is a St. John's head. These were very popular in the Middle Ages, although you'd be hard-pressed to find one now. So he always had a perpetual devotion to St. John the Baptist, and now he was going to follow through to mimic St. John. In the old gallery, certain old books, old trash, old painted cloths, old carpets, and a safe. Now, there's a funny story with the safe. The Cromwell's men saw it and said, here's the treasure, at last. We're going to find something that's worth something. So they can't open it, so they get a locksmith. He can't do it, so they need about three different locksmiths to get it open. So finally, they get it open, and a hair shirt in the wind. No treasure. So Henry was very upset, very, very agitated that there was no goods that he got. So he confiscated Fisher's library, which technically belonged to the University of Cambridge, in a shameless act to spoil it. But nevertheless, Fisher's servants had all new apparel. They had new beds. They had everything they needed. All his stuff was exactly as he found it there, because he was always the servant of the people whom he was a bishop, and not a servant of himself. So, to winding down to it, so a year winds by in the tower, and Moore and Fisher are not moved. So Henry pushes on, he gets the Carthusians in London to swear the royal supremacy. They say, we're not concerned with worldly matters. We don't have anything to do with it. So the royal officials grab him, arrest him, throw him in the tower. And eventually the Carthusians then, are taken out, and the vast majority of them refuse to swear the Act of Succession. So in April of 1535, they're taken out and martyred, all of them. And Moore, with Margaret present, can see them from his window being dragged out. So again, he knows exactly what's going on. Henry, on the other hand, is very upset. And he declares, all this mischief is because of those two miscreants, Fisher and Moore. And he tells Cromwell, I want this dealt with in 6 weeks. So Cromwell's got his orders. Just as Wolsey fell for not getting Henry what he wanted, likewise, Cromwell could be facing the same thing. So he crafts some new legislation. There's got to be a new way to get these guys. Because they haven't gainsaid the Act of Succession. They just wouldn't swear it. So he needs to invent the first exercise of thought crime. The Act of Royal Supremacy. All subjects must swear that the King of England the sole and supreme head of the Ecclesia Anglicana, and that the Pope is no more than a bishop. Anyone that maliciously declaims, denies, the king's supremacy over the church is a traitor, receives a traitor's death. Maliciously is defined even to think contrary to the act. So Fisher Moore is so good at being quiet that now Cromwell has to make up thought. And so again, they question Moore, they question Fisher. They've been doing this for some time. This is when they discover that they had correspondence. So now the doors are locked. Margaret's forbidden to see her father again. And they put the thumbscrews to them, not literally, but figuratively. Then something happens. So Pope Paul III becomes Pope, and the Cardinal Farnese. And he sees, the situation in England. He thinks it would be terrible if Fisher's killed. So he conceives the idea, if I make him a cardinal, Henry won't be able to do anything about it. He will kill a cardinal, really? So he declares Fisher a cardinal and sends a representative to the hat, asking for permission to go to England. And then Henry, in a rage, declares, let the Pope send his hat when he will, but he'll have to wear it on his shoulders. And he's not playing around. So they question Fisher very vociferously, late into the night, whether he had any correspondence with Rome, because that would be crime and error, then they could just kill him. Then on top of that, while Fisher is in the tower, a deputation of bishops come, headed by Stephen Gardiner, also by Cranmer, but Cranmer goes outside because he knows Fisher won't talk to him, and several other bishops. And Fisher, according to the early biographer, becomes downcast. He says, my lords, because they all appeal to him, take the supremacy. The best men in the realm have done. Why don't you do it? And he says, my lords, no sight have I seen sorrier than today, because I see that the fort has been betrayed by those who should have refused to talk to them again. Now, as we mentioned, two of them there, Tunstall and Bishop and Gardiner, later come back to the Catholic faith, no doubt through Fisher's prayers. But nothing had worked. So we mentioned they tried Cook, didn't work. So now it's Hooker by Crook. And the hook comes in. So they send some deputies in to examine Fisher and Moore, and they send along in one Richard Rich. Now, he was known to Moore, and Moore was fairly streetwise, but Fisher is less so. So Rich comes to Fisher and tells him, I am the king's trusty counselor, and his lordship only wants to know what it is you think about this act, just in private. It'll be no way used against you. I swear upon our very Lord himself. And so Fisher, seeing somebody swear on Christ himself, says, well, there's no right, I'll open up. So he explains to him, the king can't be the supreme head of the Church of England because that title belongs properly to the Pope. It has for centuries. So now they've got exactly what they need. He spoke against the supremacy. Rich likewise tries the same trick with Moore, and it doesn't work. You see that in After All Seasons, for instance, he won't open up to him. Because, well, one, Moore knows Rich. And two, he's not foolish enough to fall for it. He's a little more streetwise. So Fisher then is tried, and when Rich appears, he says, but this was told it wouldn't be used against me. You swore. And then he's like, what about that? So, it's clearly a show trial. Fisher then is declared guilty. He's marched back to the tower with the axe blade facing him as a sign that he's going to be executed, which Moore can no doubt see from his open door. And Fisher then, is given the night, so he takes his rest and he wakes up the next morning and barely walks. He's in advanced liver failure at this stage. He's so shrunken and skinny, he looks almost like a skeleton. So he needs assistance, and Henry commutes the sentence from being hanged, drawn, and quartered to merely being beheaded in the New Testament, a line from the Gospel of John. And this is enough to strengthen him, and then as he carries on. And then he gets to Tiber, where he's going to be beheaded. And he said, he declares that he dies for the faith of the Holy Catholic Church. And I pray for the king that God will send him a good counselor. And he leaves it there. Not as it's sometimes depicted in great fear, but great confidence and great strength. And all the people marvel to see him so old and so frail. Yet there he was, and he was laid out finally. And the executioner begged him, nailed down, begged his pardon. My lord, you know, you forgive me. He says, if you do your duty, you'll be steady with the axe. And so thus the end of the life of St. John Fisher, who was then martyred on the spot. And you know, people came and tried to dip their handkerchiefs in his blood, in a relic, it was obvious he was a saint. His body was then dug up by the men, they dug a hole really quickly nearby, just threw his body in like so much trash. They ignored it. His head was parboiled and put on a spike and led to the bridge. And although Fisher in his life never performed any miracle, in his death he performed a singular one, whereas his head exuded the smell of roses. And this is all the more remarkable because you might remember that even London, there's no sewage. There's no sewer. So, and especially on the bridge, it's not London Bridge like it is today, that's built after the Great Fire. So it was a couple of stories of apartments on either side of London Bridge going into the city. And so there are people, the chamber pots. And so the bridge did not smell very good, yet everyone who was on the bridge could smell this effusion of roses everywhere. And it was an embarrassment to Henry. It was quite obvious what had gone on. Everyone accounted it a miracle. So after 2 weeks of enduring this, and it's not going away, the smell's not going away, it's still very rosy over there. Henry decrees Fisher's head is to be taken off and thrown into the Tiber to make way for Mr. Moore. Now, Thomas Moore had been very careful and covered his tracks, but he made a lot of enemies. So finally, Cromwell decides to indict him. And for a couple of charges, so for bribery, for accepting bribes, one of those incidents with the cups. He's got more than a number of Protestants ready to accuse him. And of course, finally, also the charge of denying the act of supremacy brought by Richard Rich. So Cromwell, brings him up there, and then, Moore gets all the charges dismissed. He explains all the circumstances. He shows the evidence that for what he had actually done. So all the other charges are dismissed except the treason for denying the act of supremacy. And Richard Rich takes the stand and declares that Moore said to him this whole thing. So Moore then turns and shreds Rich's credibility and shows very clearly how he had said nothing of the sort, what he actually said, and how it could be in a merely neutral sense. And so the judges kind of floundered, but then asked the jury for his verdict, which was coerced. It was a foregone conclusion, guilty. So Moore takes a moment to speak, and then Audley was not supposed to let him speak. Thomas Audley was the new Lord High Chancellor we mentioned earlier, and so he becomes Henry's servant. And he's like Cranmer, he's going to do whatever Henry wills. And so Audley is supposed to just kind of shut it all down. And Moore declares that he wishes to speak. The king could not be head of the Church of England, because the Pope had been accorded this title by the common consent and belief of all Christendom, even before England was England. Parliament could no more make a law that gainsayed what the king had said than the king, one small part of Christendom, could attack what the Pope held. And, this moved everyone, people listened, and he went on further about the nature of these proceedings and where they would lead, and all these stumbled. Was supposed to pronounce the sentence and he couldn't. And then finally worked up the courage and he declared, the law is what Parliament, the King of England, says. Act of royal supremacy, legal positivism, the emperor divine God, whether it's democratic or monarchical, is the same thing. So Moore was let out and he had was met by his daughter one last time and then taken to the to be executed on the 6th of July, a month after Fisher, and was no longer to be seen on the earth. So he stopped and declared, I am the king's servant, but God's first. And the famous phrase. And thus was, again, his sentence too was commuted to be beheaded rather than hanged, drawn, and quartered. So Moore, who had lived very merrily at last, his dialogue for comfort says, may my enemies be forgiven, all of them, and I hope to meet them in a better better place. Prior to his arrest, even, the Duke of Norfolk, whom he had a good relationship with but was on Henry's side, had said, "Master More, don't you know what's afoot? Don't you know what's going to happen?" He said, "Aye, my lord." "Well, why don't you, you know, you accept, you know, the marriage and get on with it?" He said, "Well, my lord, what you're telling me is, I am going to die today and you tomorrow." He had no fear of death at this point. After being in the tower, strengthened by his daughter, since being desirous to be rid of worldly cares. So More's head was then put on a spike on the tower, where it stayed for a month, until Margaret More, his daughter, heard it was to be tossed into the Thames like fishers. And so she rode out and had arranged with the executioner to pay him for the head. And then she took it, where it's still fairly early, we can still see St. Thomas More's head today. I'll forget exactly where it is because it moved from its former residence. So now Henry and Cromwell have a job to do, to clean up. Right? So they got rid of their chief obstacles, and now is the cleanup. So the first thing is that Cromwell goes and confiscates all of Fisher's goods, the tomb that was prepared for him in Cambridge, all his books, and like we mentioned, the blaming Fisher for inducing Henry to write the defense of the seven sacraments, where he defended the Pope, blaming it all on Fisher. Fisher wrote it. The next thing is you have liquidating the papal supremacy. And the biggest way to do that, the one big opponent, the biggest object of devotion in England, was the cult of Thomas of Canterbury, that is Thomas of Becket, St. Thomas of Becket, who died for what, precisely? The independence of the church from the king. Right? And this is the one hill on which he died. This was the very matter of Magna Carta, right, which were promises the king will not interfere in the affairs of the church, which Henry has violated, both that and his coronation declaring the act of supremacy. So Thomas Becket's tomb is destroyed. The relics are cast into the streets to be trampled on and or otherwise burned. And thus, he, you know, seems to have gotten his own way. Right? And so he's not happy in love. He and Anne fight a year later. She's beheaded on trumped up charges of treason after giving him a daughter and not a son. And then he marries Jane Seymour, who was Catholic, and with his non-wife dead, and his real wife, who died of natural causes, no doubt induced by his treatment group, but still, Henry could have then reconciled with the church, but he doesn't, because he sees how much power he can get, and so he has no desire. He stays the course, and he does have a son, Edward, the king after him. Jane Seymour dies after his childbirth for complications, and then he's back on the marriage path years later. So there's one that he doesn't like, Anne of Cleves, Catherine Howard, who finds out has a past, so he has to behead her. And the very last one is Catherine Parr, who survives him. It'd be interesting to talk more about them, but we've been quite at length so far. So Henry was reckoned as a tyrant, a murderer, hated all throughout Europe. One time when he was looking for a princess, he had sent a message to a French princess, and she replied, "I might think about it if I had two heads." So that way I could use one. Henry was in a jousting accident, and as a result, he fell off his horse, and the horse landed on him. It's like equivalent to being hit by a train. And so he had went into a concussion, went into a coma for about 2 days, woke up finally, and his legs were full of ulcers and things. And the doctors decided they should bleed him so they could keep those things bleeding all the time. So wherever he went, he stunk like this rotting flesh. He wasn't allowed to ride. He wasn't allowed to hunt. He wasn't allowed to do his traditional athletic games, so he sat around eating, and he gets very fat, as we see in these later portraits. And so his early youthful figure is gone. Everywhere he goes, he stinks. People are afraid of him and in terror of him, and very few survive. Even Cromwell, his trusted servant, is put to death after the Cleves marriage. And so in the Charles V had, he worked with Henry later years, and hated Henry. It was said by many that even if John Fisher had been in the land of the Great Turk himself and had committed some trespass there, being so old that the Great Turk would never have put him to death, but Henry had shown himself more vicious, more wicked than Muhammad. So he's remembered with opprobrium by all, but Fisher and More, on the other hand, are always remembered, even in those times, even by Protestant kings, as great statesmen. More, for example, Charles V had said, "I would rather have lost a third of my kingdom than such a council." Fisher had great praise. He was the only bishop to take on Luther. He was the only one to actually have a convincing argument against Luther, and Luther didn't dare write back. Fisher was the only one who was being a true shepherd in his diocese, and his theology was so strong, it was a model of the Council of Trent in the discussion of justification, even more so than St. Thomas Aquinas, because he was the most recent one to have written on that subject and did so, so well. Fisher is remembered and praised by the great founder of Salamanca, Francisco Vittoria. He's also praised by St. Robert Bellarmine, who was one of the great writers of the Counter-Reformation. St. Charles Borromeo, the reforming bishop of Milan, had two portraits in his cell. One was of St. Ambrose, the founder of the See of Milan, and St. John Fisher, the model of a reforming bishop. He himself would try to live according to that model. So both men fondly remembered, because of politics, the papacy had held off any canonization of them, even though they were always referenced as the holy martyrs. And then at last, in 1935, they were both canonized. So with that, I give you St. Thomas More and St. John Fisher.